Today is Tuesday, March 30th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden warns of another COVID surge.
From Washington to Atlanta, the nation's being warned about a potential backslide in the pandemic fight.
Oslo, Islamic State claims responsibility for attack in northern Mozambique.
At the port in Mozambique's Pemba, families are anxiously waiting for news of their loved ones after a deadly attack in the northern gas town of Palma.
Plus, protesters return to Myanmar streets despite growing casualties. These stories and more are next. President Biden is urging Americans to step up efforts to stop another virus surge. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
From Washington to Atlanta, the nation's being warned about a potential backslide in the pandemic fight. New U.S. COVID-19 cases are up 10% over the past week.
If we let our guard down now, we could see a virus getting worse, not better.
President Biden echoing warnings from CDC Director Rochelle Walensky, who says she has recurring feelings of impending doom about a potential fourth wave.
I'm asking you to just hold on a little longer.
Both say some states have been too quick to roll back restrictions. The president's urging governors who've lifted mask mandates to reinstate them.
Please, this is not politics.
He's also announcing new steps to boost vaccine access, saying at least 90% of adults will be eligible for shots in 3 weeks. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Asian medical professionals on the front line of tending U.S. COVID-19 victims enter the pandemic's second year amid a surge in anti-Asian attacks. Disproportionately represented in the field compared with their census presence, the experiences of these nurses and doctors speak to courage and caring, resilience and resolve. Journalists from VOA's East Asia and Pacific Division contributed to this report, narrated by Ariadne Bodianto.
There are about 20 million Asians in the U.S. with ties to more than 20 countries. Asian healthcare providers are disproportionately represented in the field, given their numbers in the U.S. population. Many of the Asian medical professionals have overcome challenges to practice, starting with learning a new language.
I'm a Thai nurse working at University of Maryland.
For many, the career path was unexpected, but not one of those who spoke with VOA wants to do anything else, including Tibetan nurse Sering Dechen.
I was not really sure if I really wanted to become a nurse. Once I started doing my clinicals, and that's when I started falling in love with this profession.
Indonesian nurse Adam Connors arrived in the U.S. in 2011 on a tourist visa to visit France. But almost immediately, he collapsed from a seizure from undiagnosed late-stage tuberculosis. He was admitted to George Washington University Hospital in Washington, D.C., where he now works as a nurse in the ICU.
During my 3 month stay, like in the hospital, I feel like, wow, I mean, I see the nurses, especially they work really hard. You know, they're so passionate. You know, they try to help the patient. At the time it was me. So from that time, I was like decided to be a nurse.
Asian medical professionals working on the front lines of U.S. hospitals marked the past year witnessing deaths and celebrating recoveries. Lauded as heroes, some have endured racial attacks.
It's similar to the aftermath of 9/11 when, you know, folks of a darker complexion looked similar to the threats to America. And so now, you know, when we have this pandemic originated in China, you know, East Asian folks are now considered a threat to America.
Some people don't want to be tended by Asian healthcare professionals, even though they care for people of all nationalities each day. For VOA News, this is Ariadna Budianto.
Last week, a bipartisan group of former U.S. government officials issued a statement condemning the spiking crimes against Asian Americans, saying it comes as Asians face, quote, wrongful blame for the virus, unquote. Citing statistics provided by the nonprofit group Stop AAPI Hate, an acronym for Asian American and Pacific Islanders, the signatories say 2020 saw a 150% increase in hate crimes against Asian Americans. Among those who signed the document is Curtis S. Chin. He served as a U.S. ambassador to the Asian Development Bank under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and currently is Asia Fellow at the Milken Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan economic think tank. International edition Steve Miller began their conversation by asking why some in the American society are still considered, quote, outsiders, unquote, or, quote, others, unquote, when the United States is a nation of immigrants dating back to the original colonies.
When we think of the United States today, the reality is that the images that you see, whether it's in Hollywood or in newspapers or in books, is of a nation that, yes, was founded by immigrants, but the demographics, which are still changing, is a white nation, of a nation that really was shaped early on by the first settlers from, you know, England that came here. So fast forward to what is going on today, if you think about America today, yes, America is evolving, but the reality is that it is a country where many of the leaders, many of the faces that we see on TV are white Americans. You know, that's neither good or bad. What, though, needs to change is that the face of America is changing, but so too must be the face of our leaders, of our business leaders, of our government leaders. What we're seeing today, you know, in my view, is a continuation of really what happened in many ways last year when the Black Lives Matter movement really burst onto the scene. But remember, Black Lives Matter didn't just begin last year. Ongoing reckoning of America with regard to race, with regard to women, is one that has gone on for decades. The reality is that when I think about anti-Asian hate right now and all that is happening, is that we need to also think about it in terms of the context. That, you know, President Biden, to his great credit, when he called out anti-Asian hate and said, this is un-American, this is not America. Sadly, in many ways, this legacy, this present anti-Asian hate spike in violence has also been part of America.
You bring up President Biden and his statement against Asian hate, and you were part of a number of individuals, of former government officials, who released a statement condemning Asian hate. Are statements enough to affect change?
Absolutely not. Clearly, it's a step. I think all of us need to condemn racist behavior. But we need to now, you know, turn that greater awareness of what is going on into action. You know, we've seen this with regards to the Black Lives Matter movement. March is actually also National Women's History Month in the United States. And now we're seeing with this pushback against Asian hate, people are calling out racist incidents. That's terrific. But now we need to turn that into more specific actions. So in the United States, it can range from federal government, you know, nationwide legislation that passes or that takes place in Washington, you know, that's good. You know, so that would include things like calling for money to help fund the tracking of hate crimes. That it would include laws that look into really what is happening out there in communities with regards to discrimination, with regards to racist violence. So all that's important.
That's Curtis S. Chin, former U.S. ambassador to the Asian Development Bank under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and current Asia Fellow at the Milken Institute, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. 4 months after Ethiopia's government declared victory in the northern Tigray region, people are being displaced again. This time, according to witnesses and officials, it's by forces from a neighboring region seeking to settle a decades-old land dispute. Nezanin Moshiri of Reuters reports.
The dusty buses keep rolling into Shire, a town in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Dozens a day, piled high with mattresses, chairs, and baskets. And inside, people with nowhere to call home. 4 months after the Ethiopian government declared victory over the Tigray People's Liberation Front, tens of thousands are again displaced. This time, fighting is not the cause, but a decades-old land dispute. According to witnesses, aid workers and members of Tigray's new local administration, appointed by the government, they've been driven from their homes by forces from neighboring Amhara. Mother of nine, Wahed Gebri Exiavie, left her village near the start of the conflict.
Since then, I've spent 2 months going from village to village, begging. Then we came to this camp because we heard there's aid here, but there isn't much food. I get help only for the seven-month-old baby. We don't even have a carpet to sleep on. This shelter I'm staying in isn't my own. I pleaded with other families and joined them.
Fighters from Amhara entered Western Tigray in November in support of the government and have stayed ever since. Amhara officials say the disputed lands, equal to about a quarter of Tigray, were taken during the nearly three decades the Tigray People's Liberation Front dominated central government, before Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power. Tigrayan officials say the area has long been home to both ethnic groups. Mulunega, head of Tigray's administration, said Amhara special forces and militias are now forcing people out.
We believe that this is unacceptable because it's not only displacement, it's beyond that. It's even about human rights issue.
Reuters interviewed 42 Tigrayans who described attacks, looting and threats by Amhara gunmen. Two bore scars they said were from shootings. Gazacha Mulune, spokesman for the Amhara Regional Administration, said Amhara was running the contested territory, reorganizing schools, police and militia, and providing food and shelter. He did not respond to requests for comment on the accusations of violence and intimidation by Amhara fighters. Last week, Abiy defended Amhara regional forces, saying to portray them as a looter and conqueror is very wrong. Meanwhile, the buses keep arriving in Shire, carrying 1,000 people every day, according to local officials and the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. It is an exodus that risks exacerbating a precarious humanitarian situation in a region where hundreds of thousands have already been uprooted by fighting.
That's Nazanin Mushiri of Reuters. Protests has defiantly returned to the streets of Myanmar a day after security forces killed more than 100 people in the bloodiest day since the military coup. AP correspondent Karin Chamas reports.
Demonstrators in Yangon chanted in unison as they marched down the street, charged with anger by the crackdown the day before. Of the over 100 people killed, several were children under 16 years old. People came out in force in Dawei and Mandalay and were again met with police force. The number of killings since the coup has now totaled over 420, according to multiple counts. The recent violence by police and soldiers took place throughout the country as Myanmar's military celebrated the annual Armed Forces Day holiday with a parade in the country's capital, Naypyidaw. The bloodshed quickly drew international condemnation, both from diplomatic missions within Myanmar and from abroad. I'm Karen Chamas.
Islamic State has claimed responsibility for an attack on the northern Mozambique gas town of Palma and said it killed more than 50 people. Emma McCarthy of Reuters has more.
At the port in Mozambique's Pemba, families are anxiously waiting for news of their loved ones after a deadly attack in the northern gas town of Palma. Some, like Jose Abebe, are begging for help.
I'm looking for a young man. I need your help with communication to locate my son.
Since 2017, Mozambique's northern Cabo Delgado province has been the target of a simmering insurgency linked to Islamic State. On Monday, Islamic State claimed the attack on Palma, which began on Wednesday, saying it had killed at least 55 people. Around 160 miles down the coast in the provincial capital Pemba, hundreds were arriving by boat on Sunday. Omar Saranga, spokesman for the Ministry of Defence, told journalists that the focus had been on rescuing local and foreign citizens. Dozens had been killed in the attack, he said.
The Defence and Security Forces regret this loss of human lives and advise that they continue to develop, at this moment, concerted actions of pursuit, with the aim of eliminating some pockets of resistance.
A diplomat and a security source involved in the operations to secure Palmer said the government is yet to re-establish control, and the exact number of people killed and injured remains unclear. Palmer is a logistics hub for international gas projects worth around $60 billion. On Saturday, French energy group Total said it was calling off a planned resumption of construction at its $20 billion development following the attack. It also said it would reduce its workforce to a strict minimum, having already pulled out the majority of its workforce in January.
That's Imam McCarthy of Reuters. Thailand's prime minister is denying that his country's security forces are sending villagers back to Myanmar who fled from military airstrikes, and says his government is ready to shelter anyone who is escaping fighting. His comments came a day after humanitarian groups said the Thai military had begun sending back some of the thousands of people who have fled a series of airstrikes by Myanmar's military. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Afo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Shipping was on the move again late Monday in Egypt's Suez Canal after tugs refloated a giant container ship which had been blocking the channel for almost a week, causing a huge buildup of vessels around the waterway. Suez Canal Authority Chairman Osama Rabi said the backlog of 422 ships could be cleared in 3.5 days. Maha Abdurrawi of Reuters has more.
The massive cargo ship that's been blocking the Suez Canal since last week has finally been freed. And the huge backlog of other vessels, hundreds of them, waiting to pass through, is starting to move again. That's according to the Canal Authority on Monday. The 430-yard behemoth, known as the Ever Given, became stuck diagonally across a southern section of the canal in high winds on the 23rd of March when it ran aground, blocking a trade route that is used by about 15% of the world's shipping traffic for 6 days and costing the canal $14 to $15 million a day. Marcus Baker is the head of marine and cargo at Marsh Incorporated. He says it highlights the importance and vulnerability of the world's global supply chain.
I mean, this is a very significant maritime artery, one of only two major canals in the world that, you know, operate in this way in terms of moving ships from one ocean to another. You know, you've got to remember that 90% of the world's goods are moved by ship. That's why the maritime industry is still so incredibly important for global trade. So any blockage of any kind that delays things has an unprecedented impact on global trade. And that's exactly what we've seen in the last week.
The Suez Canal Authority's chairman, Admiral Osama Rabi, has said that investigations will show that the organization wasn't responsible for the incident. After dredging and excavation work over the weekend, rescue workers from the authority and a team from Dutch firm Smith Salvage succeeded in partially refloating the ship earlier on Monday using tugboats, according to marine and shipping sources. The Ever Given is now being moved to a lake that sits along the canal for inspection. Admiral Rabi has also said it could take from 2.5 to 3 days to clear the traffic jam of other ships. Shipping group Maersk said the knock-on effects on global shipping could take weeks or months to unravel.
That's Maha Abdurrawi of Reuters. Before the pandemic hit, 82% of clinics in the landlocked southern African nation of Eswatini lacked hot running water. That has changed in the last 6 months with the installation of solar-powered water heaters in every government clinic, opening up clean health facilities to up to 10,000 people a day in a nation that has long struggled with building up infrastructure. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Lubamba, Eswatini.
For more than a year, nurse Lindiwe Magongo has seen to the needs of 600 patients per week at her small clinic near the capital of Eswatini, the nation formerly known as Swaziland. Until very recently, she's fought both ordinary health issues and the global coronavirus pandemic without the most basic healthcare tool, clean, hot water. Doctors say hand washing, hygiene, and sanitation are key to curbing the spread of illness. The coronavirus has claimed nearly 700 lives in this nation of just over 1 million people. Until this month, the 92 government clinics in this mountainous nation lacked this critical tool. But in recent months, a multinational initiative has installed an outdoor solar-powered hand-washing station in every clinic. On a recent weekday, Magongo beamed at the new hand-washing station at the gate of her clinic. Dozens of Emiswati, as the people of Eswatini are called, had lined up before the clinic opened and were now filing in after washing their hands. It's not just a concrete structure consisting of a heavy sink and a durable solar water heater, she said, though it is literally that. To her, it represents possibility. Magongo says the hot water station is also used to clean the clinic and brew tea for staff. Patients can take water home if they like. VOA asked Acting Prime Minister Tema Masuku what seems like an obvious question. Why didn't the government do this before? Why wait for foreign donors? He said it's not that easy for a cash-strapped government with limited manufacturing capabilities and unreliable electricity supply. When the pandemic hit, he said, Eswatini struggled to acquire basic items like masks.
One of the priorities was to build the clinics first, because you can't put the stuff here without clinics. As we were building the clinics, as we have 92 of them now, those public health facilities, the stakeholders came in, they wanted to assist, and we gladly accepted that. So everything is prioritized. Health is one of our major priorities, and this is why we thought building the clinics before we get the hot water would be ideal.
At her small clinic in Ezulwini, Magongo said it also breaks what she described as a stigma around hand washing. Anita Powell, VOA News, Lubamba, Eswatini.
Prosecutors and defense attorneys in the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin offered sharply different views Monday on how George Floyd, an African-American man, died in police custody in Minneapolis, Minnesota. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports.
Prosecutors opened their case by showing in full a bystander's video of Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck as people on the street asked Chauvin to stop. What happened is clear, says prosecutor Jerry Blackwell.
As you will learn that on May 25th of 2020, Mr. Derek Chauvin betrayed this badge when he used excessive and unreasonable force upon the body of Mr. George Floyd.
Chauvin's lawyer says other video that the jury has not yet seen and further testimony will tell a different story. Defense attorney Eric Nelson.
The evidence will show that Mr. Floyd died of a cardiac arrhythmia that occurred as a result of hypertension, his coronary disease, the ingestion of methamphetamine and fentanyl, and the adrenaline flowing through his body.
The prosecution said forensic evidence will instead show that Floyd died at the hands of the former officer who used excessive force. Floyd was accused of passing a counterfeit $20 bill, which prosecutors say could have led to a simple citation instead of a physical confrontation. Chauvin's defense lawyer said Floyd resisted arrest, while prosecutors say that after he was subdued, he struggled to breathe. Floyd's death has triggered worldwide protests against police treatment of African Americans, but both sides say this case will hinge on facts. Defense attorney Eric Nelson.
It's about the evidence in this case. The evidence that you will see in this case during this trial. It is, I agree with counsel for the state, it is nothing more than that. There is no political or social cause in this courtroom.
But the case is also a test of the judicial system, says the son of a civil rights leader, Martin Luther King III.
America and the world is looking at whether the justice system works. And, you know, we'll be able to determine that throughout this process.
The trial is expected to last about 4 weeks, and the nation and world are watching. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth news and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.